I'd like to now call our debaters to rise to the podium and to give their opening statements on the motion. It's time to end affirmative action. Each debater has 8 minutes. I'll give a one-minute warning. First, Joseph Phillips for the motion.
Thanks. Ooh, boy. feel like I did before my first love scene with Halle Berry. So you can imagine, if you have any imagination at all, the butterflies, and actually the excitement. Because I'm here in defense of what I think is one of the cornerstones of our republic, that of non-discrimination. And I think it was articulated in Brown versus the Board of Education when decided that discrimination in our public schools was unconstitutional. It became part of our cultural lexicon a few years later when Presidents Kennedy and Johnson issued an executive order that stated clearly and unambiguously that affirmative action should be taken to ensure that hiring decisions were made without regard to race. And then, of course, it was given teeth in the law through the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was very clear that discrimination based on race was unlawful. And to quote an 80s sitcom, it's a different world from where you come from. That was then. That was good old-fashioned non-discrimination, and it was good for America. Well, times have changed, and what we're talking about now, affirmative action, is no longer about non-discrimination. It's about racial preferences, and that is what we oppose, racial preferences. Now, that doesn't mean that we believe that racism has suddenly disappeared. It hasn't. We know that racism exists. Listen, I'm 45 years old. I've been black in America for a long time. I have seen racism. I have been the victim of racism. I'm not about to stand up here and pretend that it doesn't exist. But the question before us is not, does racism exist? The question is, are racial preferences an effective means to combat racism? And the answer is simply no. There isn't any evidence at all that racial preferences actually benefits us in terms of our race relations. In fact, what evidence there is points to just the opposite. What we do know is that racial preferences tend to enhance and firm up negative stereotypes, particularly as it pertains to black intellectual capacity and academic capabilities. You know, there was a saying that my mother had, and I hear it in my head right now. There is no monopoly on brain power. That's what my mother said all the time. There is no monopoly on brain power. Black people can compete. We can compete on the athletic fields. We can compete in the symphony halls, and we can compete in the classrooms. And what's more, my mother said, you can compete, and you will compete. But there are some folks who, sadly, are going to tell my children something very different. And you don't have to take my word for it. Let's just look at what they say. Richard Atkinson, former president of the University of California at Berkeley, standing before an audience similar to this at University of San Diego, said that it was highly doubtful, if not impossible, that we would achieve diversity on our nation's premier campuses without the use of racial preferences. Now, Atkinson was not standing before a curious world telling everybody he's just a big fat racist, and unless you rein me in, I'm going to start discriminating right and left. No. What he was saying is that there is a monopoly on brain power, and that black students don't have it in sufficient quantity to show up in significant numbers in our nation's campuses. Now, if you're not sufficiently offended, as you should be, let's take something else that you often hear in discussions like this. Someone, maybe here, over here, is bound to stand up and say, well, I benefited from affirmative action. You benefited from affirmative action. She benefited from affirmative action. And of course, they're not saying, well, you benefited from non-discrimination. Well, I did, and that's a good thing. What they're saying is, I couldn't qualify, you couldn't qualify, she couldn't qualify. Absurd. Miss Kimberly Crenshaw there. I've met her for the first time. I've read what she's written. I've heard her on the radio. This is a smart, dynamic woman.
The idea that but for racial preferences, Miss Crenshaw would be standing on a corner singing doo-wop someplace is offensive to me, and it should be offensive to all in the sound of my voice. Now, you're going to hear a lot of statistics today. I'm not going to talk to you about statistics. I'm going to talk to you about people, because racial preferences impact and affect people. This past April, spring, my wife was at a birthday party with our children. And the mothers are sitting there talking. If the father's in there, you know that you tend to avoid these things like the plague. So I wasn't there. But the mothers are grouped, and they're talking about their children, where they go to school, and it comes to light that my oldest boy attends a magnet program for highly gifted students. Without missing a beat, one of the other mothers says, well, you know, now with this Supreme Court decision, they won't be able to accept kids in these programs for diversity. Well, my wife was kinder than I would have been. After she picked her jaw up off the floor, she explained to the woman, look, he's not in this program because he checked some box. You can't get in this program unless you score 99.9% on the test. Let me repeat that, 99.9% on the test. And he's making straight A's in this program. And what is more ironic is that the woman she was talking to is a teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District. That is the evil of racial preferences. That is the real-life impact of racial preferences. Teachers who lack faith in the academic abilities of their students, and children who, no matter how hard they work, no matter how broad their gifts, are stained with preference, with beneficence. That's Greek.
One.
And my child is not the only one. There are thousands and thousands of students just like him who cannot enter our nation's college campuses boldly and confidently. They enter, again, dripping with the stigma of racial preferences. And I'm here to tell you tonight that that is not good for America. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph Phillips, speaking in favor of the motion. Now, to make an opening statement against the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, Tim Wise.
Thank you. You know, it always amazes me to hear critics of affirmative action speak about this subject as if racial preference were something that were invented in the 60s to benefit people of color. Because in fact, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, and of course we don't, the entire history of this country is the history of affirmative action for white folks like myself. And unless we begin by discussing that affirmative action and the impact that it has had, we engage in a discussion that is both ethically and practically irresponsible. Contrary to what Joseph tells you, this debate is about the extent to which racism still exists, because it is indeed the existence of that racism which necessitated affirmative action in the beginning and continues to necessitate it today. Whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, enslavement, Indian genocide, segregation did not only oppress people of color, they elevated white folks and provided us with opportunities that we did not, in fact, earn. The Homestead Act allowed whites to claim over 270 million acres of land for virtually nothing down. At a time when folks of color could not. Today, there are 40 million white folks descended directly from those who received that land giveaway, millions of them still living on the property. They owe their lives to affirmative action. Then there was the FHA home loan program, which for the first 30 years of its existence operated in a whites-only fashion, lending over $120 billion worth of government-backed housing equity to whites, thereby creating the white middle class. And in large measure, because of those preferences, the typical black college couple, college-degreed couple, starts out with less than one-fifth the net worth of the typical young white couple, because the latter of those has likely received the benefits of their family's prior head start, while the former are likely to have accumulated far less, having had less chance to do so. So against that backdrop, ending affirmative action would only further cement the systemic advantages for whites that had been in place for hundreds of years. It would be tantamount to favoring those three laps ahead in a five-lap race, even though those who were ahead gained their head start as the result of an unfair process. But even worse, to end affirmative action would ignore the ongoing reality, not past, but ongoing reality of white racial preference, and not only in education, but also in employment. And let me clarify, we were not told that our remarks tonight had to focus only on higher education. That resolution doesn't mention higher education. I will not speak of it only with regard to schools, because it is not only there that it matters. According to the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, 3 out of 4 companies covered by affirmative action regulations violate them regularly, and not just that, but are also in violation of basic civil rights law. The problem is the OFCCP only has enough monitors to check up on the companies under their purview once every 46 years. So there's no deterrent. But those who would end affirmative action never call for beefing up civil rights enforcement. Indeed, though his teammates might not know it, Mr. Pell's organization advocates abolishing anti-discrimination law altogether as it regards the private sector. So Joseph can sing the praises of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but the man sitting next to him would get rid of it as it regards private organizations. So to endorse the resolution would only intensify the problem of discrimination. Those who would end affirmative action ignore the study, recent study, which found that job applicants with white-sounding names have a 50% greater chance of getting a call back for an interview than those with black-sounding names, even when qualifications are indistinguishable. They ignore not only that, but the research which has found that 8 in 10 jobs are never advertised. Instead, they're filled by networking, a process that mostly excludes people of color and women of all colors and elevates whites and men, not because we are better for certain jobs, but because we know the right people. And if affirmative action were abolished, none of that would change for the better. If anything, it would get worse. The same is true for schooling. Our opponents will rail against so-called preferences for students of color while they ignore the preferences built in for whites. So they condemn the University of Michigan for giving 20 points on a 150-point scale to students of color, but they ignored the points that were in practice essentially for whites only. Like the 16 points you got if you were from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The snow is not the only thing white there. The 10 points just because you went to a top high school, which means your parents live in the right zip code. The 8 points for taking advanced placement classes, which are 3 times more available in schools serving white kids than schools that serve mostly students of color, or the 4 points you got if daddy went to Michigan. They rallied behind Jennifer Gratz as the supposed victim of reverse discrimination because the year she was rejected, there were about 85 students of color who got into Michigan despite having lower scores in grades, but they say nothing about the 1,400, let me repeat, 1,400 white students with lower grades and lower scores than Jenny Gratz who got in. You see, less qualified white people are no problem, but less qualified people of color, my goodness, we can't have that. They say nothing about the study from 6 weeks ago which found that for every 1 student of color who receives any benefit from affirmative action in college, there are at least 2 whites for every 1 person of color, 2 whites who also didn't meet the requirements, but got in because daddy wrote a check or mama made a phone call or somebody pulled strings and got them in. But affirmative action for rich white people is never a problem for the folks like our opponents. While they insist affirmative action is racist because it holds people of color to lower standards, the fact is it is whites who have been held to lower standards. It is whites, and only whites, I would suggest, who can get C's all the way through school, brag about their mediocrity publicly, mangle the English language, and go on to become president of the United States. So, when they lament the supposed damage done to students of color by affirmative action because it supposedly forces them to question their abilities, ask yourself, why no concern for the mental health and self-image of white Americans who have been being preferred for 400 years, and if their argument is correct, must be the most self-hating people on the face of planet Earth? And no, affirmative action doesn't place people of color in positions for which they're unqualified. Indeed, once we control for economic status, comparing only whites and folks of color from families with both the same income and wealth profile, there is no difference in college graduation rates and only an insignificant difference in college grades. And black students at the most selective schools actually do better in relation to their white counterparts than those in less selective schools. Furthermore, according to 200 different studies on the subject, not just one that I'm pulling out of my ass, but 200 different studies, employees who have benefited from affirmative action perform equal to or better than their white male counterparts once given a chance to prove themselves. So in closing, unless our opponents can show you that they have some alternative mechanism for addressing that legacy of white racial preference and the ongoing advantages extended to whites in this country, unless they can demonstrate some alternative means by which true equal opportunity can flourish, to vote for them and to vote for ending affirmative action is to engage in an act of irresponsible racial aggression. It is to ignore the wisdom of Dr. King, who said quite clearly in 1963, quote, "Whenever this issue of compensatory or preferential treatment is raised, some of our friends recoil in horror. The Negroes should be granted equality, they insist, but should ask for nothing more. While at first that seems reasonable, in fact it is unrealistic, for it is obvious that if you take a man and put him at the starting line of a race 300 years after another man, the first man would have to perform some incredible feat in order to catch up." End of quote. And to end affirmative action even does violence to the logic displayed by Ronald Reagan, whose mention alongside the word logic is rare coming from me, but who said as governor of California, when signing into law that state's
affirmative action policy. Thank you, Tim Wise, for that opening statement.
I didn't get my 1 minute warning, but if I could finish the quote from, Reagan, I'd appreciate it.
I think everyone else in the room heard it. Tim, why don't you take a seat? Sorry, you'll have time later.
That's fine.
Thank you, Tim Wise. Thank you, Tim Wise, for that statement against the motion. I'll say one still louder throughout the evening. And now for a statement in favor of the motion, it's time to end affirmative action. John McWhorter, please go to the podium.
I think that when we discuss racial preferences, and I am going to largely restrict what I'm saying to racial preferences in universities, although many of these things also apply to affirmative action as handled elsewhere, we often are under the impression that what we're talking about is something as simple as a tie-breaking process, a thumb on the scale, the idea being that if qualifications are equal or more or less equal between a black and a white candidate, that one gives the nod to the black person. I personally would find nothing problematic with that policy. I don't think most people would. And to the extent that it is generally implied, generally via omission, that that's what we're talking about when we talk about racial preferences and that we're not talking about qualifications or test scores or things that we don't want to talk about, then it's understandable that there reigns a sense that to be opposed to these racial preference policies means that a person must be naive or unfeeling or have a sinister agenda or something like that. All of that is perfectly understandable. And then certain words are used, inequality, resegregation, white privilege, societal racism, etc. And all of those concepts are important. There is a great deal of injustice in the country now, and there always has been, and we should think about it. But those words also have a kind of rhetorical power that I think distracts us from the actual logic of the case here and what racial justice is. That is, how we actually solve the problems that I think we're all concerned with. And from what I've seen over my years in discussing this question, there are certain basic facts about how racial preferences are played out that we're not often told. I don't think that people who think differently than me are willfully ignoring these things. I think these things just don't get out there very much, but they are absolutely crucial to evaluating this particular case. And in my remaining 7 minutes and about 13 seconds, I just want to give you a few of those things. For one thing, affirmative action, racial preferences as we're talking about, is not just a tiebreaker. If that's really all this debate had been about, I never would have joined it. There are all sorts of things. In 1991, in terms of all of the students who were admitted to selective law schools, there were 420 black ones, 24 were admitted according to what the qualifications were considered to be appropriate for white and Asian students. All the rest of them, just based on the numbers, wouldn't have gotten in. I respect what Tim Wise has said. We have very different data in terms of the qualifications. If it were true that qualifications were the same, this would be a rather vacuous and petty debate. But the fact is that, according to anything that I know, they're not. For example, one argument that we might hear before we leave tonight is that SATs are meaningless. Now, there are dueling studies on that. I'm not sure exactly where one is to stand as a good thinking person at this point, but certainly it bears mentioning that if you looked at UC Berkeley undergraduates who were black and their graduation rates after 1988, they actually tracked in virtual lockstep with SAT scores. The lower the score, the more likely the person was to graduate. That suggests to me something that I think all of us know deep down, which is that no matter how you jigger the statistics, SAT scores do mean something. Not everything, of course, but they do mean something. Or, for example, Richard Sander has shown that with black students admitted to 163 law schools, that because so very many of them were admitted not according to the qualifications that they submitted, but out of a sense of a commitment to diversity and lowering standards, that over half of them were in the bottom 10% of their class, and that wasn't only in the first year, and that there was a truly alarming rate of failing the bar exam. Now, these are all difficult issues, but things like this, and needless to say, I could go on for a very long time, but I've only got 8 minutes, they have to be brought into a debate like this. They cannot be ignored. They cannot be trivialized. These things are real. Also, to eliminate racial preferences at selective universities does not deny black people an education. At UC San Diego, before the ban on racial preferences out in California, exactly one out of 3,268 freshmen who were black were making honors. After the ban, 20% of black students were making honors because the students who would have been admitted to Berkeley or UCLA were now admitted to UC San Diego. I think that was a good thing. It certainly wasn't a bad thing, and it's something that needs to be talked about. Let's talk a little bit about diversity, because I think that's going to come up. For one thing, I remember being in college, and this is purely anecdotal, but the idea of someone calling on me in class to talk about, you know, my take on the black experience or what the black perspective on things was something that made me sweat bullets, and I've heard this from countless black undergraduates, many of whom tell me when I'm doing a book tour that to them that's evidence that there's racism at universities, that they're expected to be diverse representatives. So we can talk about diversity, but how does it actually feel to be a diverse person? More to the point, it's often said that diversity has been proven to make for a better quality education. Has it? How? Like, if you've ever actually looked into that, the people who try to prove it with studies, and none of them are conservatives, find again and again that, as I think we all knew, diversity does not really have anything to do with giving you a more beneficial experience in terms of how much knowledge you have in your head or how much moral wisdom you have in your head after you come from college. There was a poll of University of Michigan minority law school grads from 1970 to 1996. For them, being called on as a diverse person in class was at the very bottom of what they valued most about their experience, as was the diversity. What they most valued in their experience was how smart teachers and their fellow students were. Remember, this is minority students. Or J. Mitchell Chang showed that in terms of diversity in your undergraduate experience, it did mean that you talked about race more on campus, but it didn't mean that you had more friends of another race, and it didn't improve your GPA, and it didn't improve how you felt about going to college. Stephen Cole and Eleanor Barber have shown that when black students are placed in schools where they actually would have been more appropriately placed in terms of qualifications, and qualifications do matter, into schools like these, then what happened is that they made lower grades, which discouraged them from going to get PhDs. This was a study done by good liberal people. They did not expect it. But that means that we have fewer black academics because of these policies. Now, based on the things that I've mentioned, clearly they belong at the table. I do want to say one thing. The idea that all of these sorts of things that I've discussed and the fact that there are other ways of addressing this problem are there, and they're worth talking about. The notion that anybody would say that a legacy student is something that black students should be proud to compare themselves to, or that a legacy student is something that is okay, I don't get it. I met legacy students when I was in school. It was not a pretty picture. I certainly do not agree with these legacy policies. However, because I'm black, I'm talking about this kind of policy as it is applied to people of my race because I think that it hurts them. I'm not going to make some hoary argument about the Constitution or something like that. I don't think that it helps black students to be the best that they can be. And I think I'll stop there, But there are issues in this debate that we simply don't hear about. It's not as simple as just being against resegregation and calling for diversity. Thank you.
You can stop right there, in fact. Thank you. John McWhorter, thank you for that statement. Supporting the motion, it's time to end affirmative action. Now a statement from Kin Mei Ong against the motion.
Well, one thing that John McWhorter's right about is that we are going to talk about diversity today, and it's not because I'm not advocating it because I believe that every black person has the same experience, and because I believe that black people should have to carry the mantle of the black experience for our educational benefit any more than I represent the same perspective as any other Asian person. I want to tell you a little story about my own experience. Very recently, I bought a house in the Ditmas Park area of Brooklyn, and it's been heralded as the most diverse census tract in the country. And so when I moved there, I found that, you know, the adults, they were a little bit more hesitant to mix, but the young people at the pizza place hung out with people of all different backgrounds, and little kids at the playground were willing to play with each other from all different backgrounds. And this is something that I value. It's not something that I think is easy. It's not something that I think comes naturally, but it's something that will only happen when people go to school together, when people are exposed to each other, and preferably at an earlier age and also in higher education. And so you should vote with us if you agree with that statement, if you agree that a racially diverse environment is beneficial, if you believe that diversity enhances the educational experience and that diversity is good for business and the economy. You should also vote with us if you want a level playing field, not a false meritocracy that is actually full of hidden benefits for the children of donors and legacies. Now, some of you may be wondering why I, a lawyer at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, is here speaking out in support of affirmative action. Foes of affirmative action often like to say that Asians are the ones the most harmed by affirmative action. That's simply not true. First of all, many Asian groups, Southeast Asians in particular, who face numerous educational disadvantages, need and benefit from affirmative action in all contexts, in particular, higher education. And all Asian Americans need and benefit from affirmative action in employment. So I want to echo what Tim Wise said, is that we're talking not just about diversity, about affirmative action in education. We're talking about affirmative action in a variety of different contexts, including education, public contracting, and so forth. And we're also not just talking about a black and white paradigm. We're talking about how affirmative action benefits other people of color as well as women. So you should vote for us if you value a diverse and inclusive society and want a broad variety of experiences and viewpoints represented at our most prestigious educational institutions and workplaces. Business leaders have long realized the value of diversity. When the University of Michigan's affirmative action programs were challenged before the United States Supreme Court, 65 leading American businesses and their CEOs filed a brief in support of affirmative action. These included American Express, Chevron, Microsoft, Boeing, Nike, and the list goes on. They realize that the leaders of tomorrow need exposure to diverse people, ideas, and perspectives. These companies found that individuals educated in a diverse setting were more likely to succeed, and they had very concrete examples of these benefits. They believed that they realized that people who were educated in a diverse setting were more likely to facilitate creative problem-solving approaches. They can develop program products that appeal to a diverse customer base, that they're better able to work with diverse business partners, clients, and employees, and they're more likely to contribute to a positive work environment. These companies need, and I quote, the talent and creativity of a workplace that is, or a workforce rather, that is as diverse as the world around them. Minority professionals are also more likely to provide needed services to underserved communities, and this has been found in studies about minority doctors. Incidentally, I think that this point was acknowledged by my colleague John McWhorter on the other side. In a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1996, it found that black and Latino communities were four times more likely to have a shortage of doctors. And incidentally, black doctors tend to practice in communities with five times as many blacks as communities where other doctors practice. They also have more black patients and more Medicaid patients. Latino doctors, similarly, tend to practice in communities with twice as many Latinos as communities where other doctors are, and they also have more Latino patients and more uninsured patients. You should also vote with us if you believe in leveling the playing field. women and minorities still face obstacles gaining admissions in our most selective universities and workplaces. And the College Board's own studies show that SATs are skewed in favor of whites and the wealthy. So, you know, do I say that the SAT is meaningless? Probably not. But what is that meaning, and who is it skewed in favor of? And despite these advantages that whites still have with standardized tests, there are still twice as many whites as minorities with below-average scores in the top universities, and this is because their legacies are the kids of donors. Legacies are three times more likely than general population to be admitted at Harvard and 2.5 more times at Yale, and over half of legacies are admitted at Dartmouth and Penn. Now, turning to Asian Americans, foes of affirmative action, as I said, love to use us as a poster child for who would benefit if affirmative action ended, and this is just not true. First of all, Asians have voted decisively in favor of affirmative action in both California and Michigan when these policies were challenged. And now, it's true that some Asian American students have done remarkably well in higher education, and these are disproportionately the children of highly educated professionals who immigrated here predominantly from East Asia and South Asia, starting with the change in immigration law in the 1960s. But there are other Asian American students that face considerable educational barriers, in particular Southeast Asians, who are the children of refugees who fled here after the Vietnam War from Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. I do a lot of my work in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is the second largest Cambodian enclave in the country. A third of Lowell's school children are Asian, predominantly Cambodian. But 45%, a disproportionate number of Lowell's dropouts and students who are dismissed for severe truancy are Asian American. Almost one in two Hmong, and the Hmong are an ethnic group that hails from Laos, and over one in four Cambodians in the United States have had no formal schooling whatsoever. In the affirmative action plans endorsed by the United States Supreme Court in the University of Michigan cases, you can consider a broad array of diversity factors, of which coming from a family of Southeast Asian refugees can count. Proposition 209 ended affirmative action in California in 1996. Coincidentally, this was the same year that I graduated from Bolt Hall School of Law. And as an aside, it was the diversity at Bolt, Bolt was very diverse at the time, that in part inspired me to be a civil rights lawyer. And after affirmative action ended, diversity within the Asian American population has suffered at most selective University of California schools. At Bolt Hall School of Law, there were more than four times as many Filipinos with affirmative action than without. And overall, the number of Asian Americans has dropped by 1% at all UC law schools in the first 3 years without affirmative action. Whites, on the other hand, increased by 12%. At UC Berkeley undergrad, a study by the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center found less than 50 total Cambodian, that's far less than 1%, less than 50 total Cambodian and Lao at UC Berkeley in 1993. And the case for affirmative action in employment is even clearer for Asian Americans. There's less than 1% of partners at major law firms are Asian American, and less than 1% of senior managers at Fortune 1000 and Fortune 500 firms. That's very similar to the rates of representation for blacks and Latinos, but white men are 97% of senior partners or senior management at Fortune 1000 and Fortune 100 firms, even though they're only 43% of the workplace. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Before we hear from Terrence Pell and later Kim Crenshaw, I have a couple of quick questions for panelists who've spoken already, or a couple of them. First, I'd just like to ask Joseph Phillips, I'll ask you. How do you answer the argument that was made by, among others, General Norman Schwarzkopf and the amicus brief in the Michigan case, that the military needs, for reasons of morale and national security, it needs black and Hispanic officers, and to have an appropriate number of senior black and Hispanic officers, one of the tools is affirmative action. Is that a reason for which you would say, okay, I'd prefer that result than whatever other result might emerge from colorblindness in the process?
No, I would answer him with the words of Colin Powell, who in talking about affirmative action talked about colorblindness. I can't remember the exact quote, but what Colin Powell says is that if you're talking about removing barriers, if you're talking about non-discrimination, so that then he's all for it, I'm all for it, everyone here is for it. If you're talking about putting people in places of over the not the ruling of men, but you know, officers over mm-hmm. groups of men who are not qualified. That is not what Colin Powell endorses, and I'm positive that that is not what Norman Schwartz.
So in being selected for some program that might lead one to advancement, that selection process should be absolutely colorblind, not look to make sure you're sending up a couple of minority candidates up with a group, regardless of metrics.
No, of course not. I think that clearly undermines the confidence that you need to have in a fighting unit.
Okay. Tim Wise, I have a brief question for you. Yeah. If the race-conscious policies of the government have created the inequities that
right.
you've cited, and you feel that race-conscious policies are justified in redressing them, how far would you go? What about race-conscious tax policies? Why don't we have refundable tax credits for members of minorities, and you and I can pay the alternative male whiteness tax, we pay the
right.
AMWT, and that way we can go right to the end result of the unfair competition and redress it.
Right.
Or do you draw the line at colorblindness?
No, I would look, the example you give I wouldn't endorse, but I would endorse the government of the United States and those corporations and their existing entities that stem from other entities in past generations mm-hmm. that profited from and made possible the institutionalization of white
privilege.
But
why not an extra exemption?
I would say I wouldn't do it in tax policy. I believe, and we can come back and debate the issue of substantive repair and restoration and reparation some other time. We're not here to debate it tonight. I would support the government doing that. I'm not saying white folks should take out our checkbook and have a line item for black people, you know, but I would suggest that the government, which made possible the institutionalization of this systemic inequality, has an obligation to rectify it by many means, of which affirmative action is one. It's not the only one, and it may very well not be the best one, but it's one, and it's the one we're here to discuss tonight, and to get rid of it won't bring us to any of the other possibly better options that we could discuss at a later time.
More discussion to come. Thank you, Tim, and more opening statements. First from Terrence Pell, speaking for the motion, it's time to end affirmative action.
Thank you. Look, for the last 40 years, America has been engaged in a massive social experiment to see whether the use of racial preferences could bring about the full integration of American society. The question tonight is whether these preferential policies can deliver on that promise. And the question need not be abstract, nor need it divide liberals and conservatives. That's because in the last decade, a growing body of data has become available that helps us get a handle on the trade-off between attending an elite institution on the basis of different admission standards or attending a less prestigious institution. Let's start with the effect of racial preferences in undergraduate colleges. I'm going to focus on one specific academic area, namely science. Not many minority students enter science, and many who do drop out along the way. Blacks receive about 5.3% of the bachelor's degrees in science, despite making up about 9% of the college enrollment. Well, research into these disparities by Dartmouth psychologist Rogers Elliott provides a template of the kinds of questions we should be asking, not just in the area of science, but in every area where preferential policies are employed, because it turns out that the preferences themselves are part of the problem. The first thing that Elliott's data does is dispel the assumption that non-Asian minority students somehow aren't interested in science. In fact, high-achieving black and Hispanic high school seniors are more interested in majoring in science than whites. The second thing the data tells us is that the really elite research universities, the schools that recruit the most promising students, black and white, use significant racial preferences to enroll the most gifted and talented black and Hispanic undergraduates. Elliott's 1997 study, which focused on four Ivy League schools, found that the mean SAT math score for black students was 100 points below that of white students. That difference was about 1.6 standard deviations of the white scores. This means that the black mean was not only below the white mean, it was so far below the white mean that the majority of black students had scores in the bottom 10% of the distribution of scores of all students. Now, right away, this significant use of race preferences by the most elite schools is significant. The fact that the very top schools that have their pick of the best students are using preferences of this magnitude suggests that the next tier of schools are likely using greater preferences, and in fact, second-tier schools do use greater preferences. About 15% larger than those used by the top schools. As a consequence, many black and Hispanic students up and down the line are attending schools where their credentials are significantly out of line with those of their classmates. Well, one possible response at this point, and we may hear this later on tonight, is to say that the SAT math score doesn't fairly measure black academic success. One could even deny that admitting black students with lower SAT math scores amounts to a preference. Well, we could debate this all night, but the research on this point is undisputed. If anything, grades and SAT scores overpredict black performance. So admitting blacks and Hispanics with significantly lower test scores and grades makes it all but certain that blacks and Hispanics as a group will get lower grades in college. And that's just what Elliott found. Blacks interested in science at these schools had grades almost a full GPA lower than whites. For many students, many minority students, this made it difficult to continue in science, and Elliott found that only a third of the blacks who started in science at elite schools completed a degree in science. The rest switched majors or dropped out altogether, and this rate was twice the rate of white students at those schools. Second, the lower grades of those who did finish disadvantaged them significantly, both in going on to graduate school and getting jobs. Well, if the story ended here, you might think the test score gaps make it highly unlikely that blacks will ever, or a significant number of blacks will ever succeed in science. This would be a very dreary conclusion if it were true, but the fact is it's not true. This is where the data tells us something very interesting that helps us get a handle on the real problem with preferential policies, because it turns out that the absolute value of a student's math SAT score in high school grades is less important as the relative difference between one's credentials and those of his or her classmates. How do we know this? Well, it turns out that black students interested in science who attend schools where their math SAT scores more closely match that of other students persist in science at much higher rates, even though the average SAT scores at these schools is lower. So, for example, Howard University, a historically black college, has average SAT math scores of about 450, well below the mean of the SAT score at the elite schools we've been discussing. Yet Howard is the top producer of black undergraduate science and engineering degrees in the country. What's more, a large percentage of undergraduate science majors at Howard and other historically black colleges go on to get PhDs in science. Of the top 21 undergraduate producers of black PhDs in the country, 17 of the 21 are historically black colleges, and none are among the 30 or so most selective schools that routinely recruit the most talented black high school students. And so what we have is this perverse system. The institutions with the poorest track records for producing black PhDs in science are getting the best minority students, and then driving them out of science at twice the rate of white students. And the institutions with the best track record are getting the middling students, and then producing the overwhelming majority of black PhDs in science. Well, what lessons can we draw from this? First, the existence of racial inequalities in society, which nobody on this side of the table denies, is not a sufficient justification for preferential policies. It's bad enough that African Americans are so substantially underrepresented in science. It's completely inexcusable that racial preferences end up frustrating and discouraging the gifted black high school seniors who say they want to study science. Second, it is misleading to evaluate racial preferences in the abstract, as if we're talking about one or two institutions that use preferences in a handful of deserving cases. What we're dealing with, the problem that we've got, is the systematic use of racial preferences by every single institution of higher education in the country. I've used my time to focus on one specific problem in some detail, but a growing body of research shows similar effects in many other areas. Surely all of us can agree that schools should be required to publish graduation rates and grade distributions, and yes, persistence in majors, broken down according to the different preferences granted, and that means all of them, including racial preferences, alumni preferences, and athletic preferences. The problem is the same in all cases. But more fundamentally, we need to ask ourselves why we tolerate the systematic use of race preferences. Every Supreme Court precedent in this area has held that racial preferences are a last resort, yet schools continue to treat preferences as a sacred cow they must defend to the death. Thank you.
Thank you, Terrence Pell, speaking in favor of the motion. Now, to give the last of the opening statements against the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, Kimberly Crenshaw.
Hi, I'm Kim, and I am a beneficiary of affirmative action. Despite what our opponents want you to think, Americans continue to support affirmative action for women and for people of color. When the precise question of eliminating affirmative action was put to voters in Houston, Texas, the majority repudiated this radical agenda. In supporting affirmative action, Americans inherently know that while it is one thing to pull down those no trespass signs, it is another task altogether to build pathways to and through our institutions that are genuinely and visibly open to all. This continuing support of affirmative action is even more remarkable given how the media and lukewarm supporters have acquiesced to the terms of the debate that have been set by well-funded, think tank-produced critics. Think for just a moment about what is missing in the way that affirmative action is usually framed. The debate is usually premised on the metaphor of an equal opportunity race, where we all begin at the starting line. The societal awards go to the swiftest and the most talented. Now, the problem with affirmative action, as we are led to believe, is that it distorts the race by giving some people a head start halfway around the track. So when the winner is a woman or a person of color, or for goodness sakes, a woman of color, supposedly we all know that it isn't because she was the swiftest runner or thinker or planner, but because of the head start that she happened to get. Now, some supporters of affirmative action will agree that the runner got a head start, but will justify the head start in terms of a diverse society. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm all for diversity. It's the language of inclusion used by the military, by corporate America, virtually all colleges and universities, and yes, by the Supreme Court, too. These are good allies to have on our side, and on this one, they're firmly with us. But while all sides of this debate focus on the disabilities of the runner, they wind up missing entirely the crippling conditions of the track. So what if instead of training our gaze at the runner, we looked instead at the conditions of the track? What if we really looked at the different lanes that America's runners have to run in? If we look at that, we see that some of those lanes are nicely paved, even surfaces, beautifully well lit with freshly painted lines. Other Americans, though, have to navigate lanes that are riddled with obstacles and debris, where to stay in the race, they have to climb walls, scale barriers, cross over craters, avoid detours, and confront a host of conditions that others never face just in order to even see the finish line. Affirmative action is quite simply a commitment to remove the effects of these obstacles that impede the race for some using a wide variety of tactics and strategies. Now, the other side will riddle us with language about preferences. They'll talk about racial preferences. They won't talk about gender preferences as a way to get you to forget what you know about the track and to focus instead on what you think you know about the runners. Now, there's a wealth of information that gives content to the obstacles that run a full gamut from traditional discrimination in employment, where blacks with a high school diploma actually lose out in the competition to whites with a criminal record, and where the same resume receives 50% fewer white callbacks than black-sounding names do, to underfunded schools. School districts with the highest concentration of black students receive the lowest share of resources, and the prison to the school to prison pipeline, where kids as young as six are handcuffed and sit on a fast track to prison rather than a highway to college, to hypersegregation that isolates minorities from key social networks through which most job seekers actually find employment, to newer evidence about stereotype threat that makes gifted students underperform on high-stakes tests, to implicit bias that unconsciously shapes people's attitudes and their behaviors towards minorities, that makes cops think they see a gun instead of a wallet, that makes teachers think they see an imbecile instead of a hungry child, that makes men think they see a ball-busting diva rather than a high-performing manager, that makes highway patrollers think that they see traffickers transporting drugs rather than a high school basketball team celebrating a nail-clinching victory. This evidence from disciplines as diverse as sociology, economics, law, cognitive science reflects just the barest summary of the conditions that are out there. Modest efforts to build bridges and patches over these obstacles are not preferences. They are corrections to ensure equal opportunity. Now, to be sure, there are preferences that are up there, and they are dangerous and obsolete. I'm talking about the preferences for wealth, for legacies, for power, for social networking, preferences that permit this privileged and lucky cohort to simply show up at the race to win. They don't have to run. They don't have to work hard. No one scolds them or their families or their communities about discipline, and they don't have to break a sweat. Let's take the guy up there on the people mover. Through his family's money, his daddy's connections, a bunch of good old boy backers, a society trained to look the other way, this guy can get a C average at Yale, enjoy an undistinguished record at Harvard B School, and in due course simply lean over to the finish line to receive the most coveted job in the country. If there is a poster boy against real preferences, who better than George Bush? But now, how is it that this colossal preference that attends to the privilege is overlooked? I call it, look, it's a black man's strategy. Look at this. Check this out. Now, this cover appeared on Newsweek during the controversy over affirmative action at the University of Michigan. Affirmative action, 10 ways to think about it now. Now, let's think about this picture for a minute. What are at least three ways that we're told we're supposed to think about affirmative action? It's important for you to know that Newsweek was communicating a message here. This person wasn't a student involved in Michigan. He was a model. He was photographed many times with various attire to arrive at the picture that showed the message that Newsweek wanted you to know. As Janine Jackson reported in her study of affirmative action, media coverage routinely focuses on race, not gender, on blacks, not other people of color, on elites, not people of color from all classes and both genders. White women are the single largest group to benefit from these programs, as reported by the labor statistics, but you certainly wouldn't know it from the way the media covered it. What does this tell you about the nature of the debate when, in fact, the real picture of affirmative action looks a little bit more like this? Well, what it's supposed to tell you is that affirmative action is, in fact, about people of color of all races, and it's supposed to tell you that it's actually about women as well. So I submit that people of goodwill should recoil from the bait-and-switch tactic. They should recoil from any kind of argument that frames this solely in terms of racial preference and solely in terms of one group. I would submit to you that the proposal to eliminate affirmative action repudiates King's call that day standing in front of the statue of Abe Lincoln to make good on its promises of fairness, freedom, and equality. It substitutes that soaring oratory for a simple three-monkey solution to our problems. We can make it all go away if we agree to see no evil, speak no evil, and
Kimberly Crenshaw. Thank you. A couple of quick questions for me before the next part. Terrence Pell, the motion says it's time to end affirmative action. That leaves open at least the possibility for people on your side that there was a time when it wasn't time to end affirmative action. Was there a period when confronted with many American institutions that were overtly segregationist, that excluded people, was there a time when it was appropriate to have affirmative action, or would you say never? No, this is for Terrence Bell.
Clearly, institutions that operated completely segregated systems had to do something more than remove the fact of segregation itself. They had to take affirmative steps to break down the barriers that they themselves had created. That was the original idea of affirmative action, and it made sense then. But since then, it's grown into the systematic use of preferences all over the place, and that's just a completely different
use. But you're describing places of de facto segregation. If there was a very small population of minorities, there would be a case there.
No, I'm talking about particular institutions.
Only particular institutional segregated
to remedy their own discrimination.
Otherwise, there's never been a case for affirmative action.
That's what I think. That's right.
Okay. And Kim Crutch, I have a question for you, which is, if it makes good sense to admit a minority applicant to law school for good reason, even though that candidate's test scores and grades would not qualify for admission if it were a white applicant, does it equally make sense at the bar exam, where there's a great disparity in success, to say, let's have a lower grade for passing for minority candidates? It's different. We see a racial disparity. Why not? What's the difference between that and qualifying with grades?
Well, I think there's a case to be made that all standardized tests are deeply problematic, and there's plenty of cognitive social science to suggest that. So if we're asking about whether there are alternative ways to measure merit, if there are alternative ways to measure the predictability of success, I'm all for it. The main point of this argument, however, is whether we should eliminate affirmative action in the admissions of in colleges and law schools. And
but,
the reality
is, Tim Wise said,
let me point this out. The reality is that what the other side will refuse to tell you is that those tests do not tell you anything about the success of minority students and lawyers in the profession. President Bach, President Bowman, guys who were president of Harvard and Princeton, proved that the level of success for people who are admitted through affirmative action to higher education and law school in particular are as successful, if not more.
But just notwithstanding the contours of the argument, my bar exam question, that's different?
I'm not saying it's different. I'm saying that the proposal that you're asking right now is whether we should eliminate affirmative action. If we want to talk about other ways to minimize the discrepancies and to minimize the other kinds of discriminatory effects on other standardized tests, I'm all for us talking about that.
Okay. Well, I'm now going to announce the results of our pre-debate audience vote, first of all. You voted before the debaters began, the panelists began debating, and the results were as follows. 34% of you voted in favor of the motion, it's time to end affirmative action. 44% voted against, and 22% were undecided. And again, at the conclusion of the debate, we'll poll you a second time. To begin the discussion portion of our evening, we're going to try something different. I'd like to ask each of our panelists to pose a question to someone on the opposing side. Joseph Phillips, first, you're in favor of the motion. A question from you for Tim Wise, who's against it. And you'll have about 1 minute to answer that question, or you'll have exactly 1 minute to answer that question.
Make the actor go first. I'm going to be protesting outside of here. I have two questions.
Well, let's have one question. It's hard enough to answer
I'm
one
trying
question
to choose which
seconds.
One. Well, I'll ask this one. I'd like to know, I listened to Tim's speech, and I thought and wanted to know, why is it that that blacks or that youth seem to think that blacks can only achieve when the playing field is level?
Well, I don't say that black folks can only achieve when the playing field is level. I'm making a moral argument that the playing field should be level, because for it not to be is an injustice. I'm talking about it from an ethical perspective. I happen to think people of, you know, Madam C.J. Walker was the first black millionaire, and she made it in 1911 when 67 black folks got lynched. But I don't think we would say, well, hey, if Madam C.J. could make it, you know, all y'all could have made it. Because she was selling beauty products to black women that white folks didn't want to make. Good for her. But no one in their right mind would have said, see, everybody should go out there and work. So I think folks can succeed. The question is, what are our obligations as a society to create a level playing field? It has nothing to do with what the outcome can or cannot be. It has to do with what is right and what is just and what is proper. And I would guess, just a guess, that when people have equal opportunity, they are indeed more likely to succeed. I'm pretty willing to stand on that this evening.
And Tim Wise, opponent of the resolution, it's time to end affirmative action. Why don't you pose a question to John McWhorter, who supports that motion?
Sure thing. John, you suggest that people of color are potentially less qualified, as evidenced by their college performance, maybe should go to less selective schools as a result. So given that, what should we conclude, the people in the audience and those of us up here, from the data which suggests that men, on average, also receive far lower college grades than women of all races and ethnicities? Does that mean that men are unqualified for the slots that they receive in colleges and law schools, and that maybe they should lower their sights to second and third tier schools and leave the best slots and opportunities for all the women? And if it doesn't mean that, why doesn't it mean that, given your argument about race?
John McWhorter, your answer.
Tim, I'm not sure that you're aware of the degree of the discrepancies that I'm talking about. I mean, we've long known about those particular gender discrepancies, and if we're going to talk about a kind of mindless bean counting, then no, I'm not in favor of that kind of address of racial preferences. But when you're dealing with schools which, before a ban on preferences, have a stark two-tiered system where black students are crashing and burning at much faster rates, then I think that in terms of arguing about morality and how we address the past and how we help people cope with a nation where I don't think that the playing field could ever possibly be perfectly level, that there is an issue for talking about racial preferences rather than what you're talking about.
And John McWhorter, why don't you pose a question to Ken Mei Ong, who is an opponent of the motion.
Can I just ask you this? If when there are racial preference policies, at least in universities, one unpleasant byproduct can be a sense among a certain group that a certain level of performance is just the highest that one does because that's just ethnically authentic. This is something that I saw when I taught at UC Berkeley. A very smart young woman during the ban on racial preferences told me that she was an undergraduate working in the recruiting office, was discouraging black applicants from coming to UC Berkeley if they made really high SAT scores and had really good grades. And I asked her why, and she said, in all seriousness, we're afraid that black students who perform at that high a level aren't going to have a social commitment to the black community at Berkeley. In other words, high achievers are not really black. How would you respond to that in terms of your support for racial preference policies?
I'm sorry, could you clarify the question? There's a lot.
How would you respond to the point that if standards are lowered for a particular group over a long period of time, after a while that may be the best that that group ever does because they've never been asked to do better?
Well, first of all, standards are not lowered. Diversity is a genuine benefit that occurs at an institution, both for the beneficiary and for other students at that institution. Secondly, beneficiaries of affirmative action are qualified. Students with very low test scores are never going to get it unless they happen to be legacies or children of donors. All beneficiaries of affirmative action have test scores and other criteria where they are able to succeed, and they do succeed. In this 1998 study by the two presidents of the university that Kim Crenshaw mentioned, the Shape of the River, it found that black students at the most prestigious institutions actually graduated at a higher rate than black students at less selective institutions. They had very similar career arcs once they graduated. They had the same rate of getting advanced degrees, and they were actually more likely than whites to get advanced degrees in law, medicine, and business. So I would say that they are qualified and they are succeeding.
And your question now, Ken Mei Ong, you posed the motion, put a question to Terrence Pell, who argues in favor of it.
All right, I too am trying to decide between two questions. So the question that I'm going to ask, actually, it's not related to your particular comments today, but I understand that the organization that you work for, the Center for Individual Rights, has a position that civil rights laws should not apply to the private sector. And so I'm wondering, is that what, if you'd like to explain that position? I mean, if we were back in the 60s when we had black students trying to be served at lunch counters in the South, would you be standing behind the students or would you be standing behind the diners?
Terrence Bell.
Yes, well, the simple answer is that's not our position and it never has been our position. We routinely rely on these civil rights laws like Section 1981 and Title VI in our lawsuits. Those laws are primarily directed towards discrimination by private entities and private individuals. So our organization not only is not attacking those laws, we're using those laws and we fully support the use of those laws in the various investigative agencies to go after identifiable acts of discrimination by individuals and private entities. So the premise of your question is false.
I take it I can't respond to that.
You can. Well, there are 20 seconds left. I think you'll be able to get to it a little bit later, perhaps.
Well,
in
I was just
going to
say.
Question from the audience.
My understanding is it was on your website in 2004.
That's false.
That is false. No. In any case, Terrence Pell, it's now your opportunity to put a question to Kim Crenshaw.
Kimberly, if it turned out, if the evidence developed in, that race preferences or preferential policies turn out to pose barriers to minority success, similar to the barriers you identified in your talk, would you reconsider your support for them?
I would certainly reconsider the actual form at which affirmative action takes place. However, I think that most affirmative action programs across the country actually try to attenuate themselves to the actual condition. So you all are talking about affirmative action, racial preferences, as though they are one program. They actually function in one kind of way. When, in fact, there are hundreds of affirmative action programs, ranging from affirmative action and admissions, ranging from outreach programs, development programs, information programs.
37.
All of these forms of affirmative action have been shown to be effective for the particular obstacles that they are meant to overcome. The issue that I see is that, for the most part, when we see various failures to perform, we tend to focus on the individuals rather than saying this is a wake-up call to our institutions. Our institutions know how to integrate equally. Do they know how to educate equally? That's the question that is raised.
Thank you. Kimberly Crenshaw, speaking and answering that question. She is one of our panelists opposed to the motion. We have lots of time for your questions for members of the audience right now, and I'd like to call on you. I got 1 minute ahead of myself. Kimberly Crenshaw, it's your turn to put a question to Joseph Phillips.
So, Joseph, I want to clarify what I think is a confusion, particularly in Colin Powell's position, but I also see it as a confusion that I've heard a lot coming from the other side on Martin Luther King, about what is affirmative action and what is a preference. Is it your understanding that Colin Powell does not support affirmative action, to put it more specifically, that he believes that promotions in the armed forces should be absolutely colorblind? Because that is decidedly not what he says.
Joseph Phillips.
It's my position that affirmative action in the form of racial non-discrimination is a good thing. It's good for America. That's what Colin Powell says. Racial preferences are not a good thing, and I don't believe that that's what Colin Powell says.
So are you saying affirmative action is a racial preference and Colin Powell agrees with you on that?
No, that's I said in my...
We're down to a factual question. When Powell spoke at the 96th Republican Convention, he didn't defend affirmative action in that speech?
You're asking me to go back. You take one speech that someone made, and they may have said other things at other times during other conversations. So I don't know what he said during that particular
speech. It's in his book.
Okay.
And I think that accurately reflected his sentiments.
The only point is, if you're going to use people to support your position, you should be actually clear that that's their position.
But wait a minute, I haven't heard from you
exactly
what you said. I heard you tell me that I was wrong. I didn't hear the quote.
Read the book.
I did read the book. Do you have the quote? Or are you just yelling out from the audience?
The quote can be found at www.aapf.org.
In other words, you don't have the quote. You're just free
action.
To say I'm wrong
enough,
without having
enough
the quote.
On Colin Powell's book.
Go read it.
And I'm sorry to have jumped the gun a moment ago. And for the benefit of my radio producer, I'll repeat what I said. We have lots of time left for your questions from the audience. To our panelists, I'd like you to wait until I'd like you to raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Someone with a microphone will find you. When that person does and I call on you, would you please stand up and keep your question, if you can, please keep your question brief and to the point. Do as I say, not as I do. And then we'll start by taking a question at a time. Here's a gentleman here. Sir, you're right there.
Thank you very much. Booker T. Washington, if I'm correct, opposed legislative mandates to address racism, as did Barry Goldwater, who was anything but a racist, contrary to popular belief. I'd like to ask any of the panelists on either side to what extent, from a philosophical and constitutional perspective, either of those two gentlemen were right or wrong, and why.
Kimberly Crenshaw, you're the law professor. I'll turn to you first.
Well, it's not surprising that there have been African Americans throughout history who have disagreed, sometimes profoundly, with the positions of the majority of African Americans as to what kind of intervention should be put forward to better their condition. It's important to recognize in this context that every significant program that has ever been introduced to assist African Americans to actually achieve freedom and equality has been denounced as a preference. From the Emancipation Proclamation, which was seen as giving them a preference, giving them something that they didn't deserve, which was basically the value of their labor, to anti-discrimination law that would protect them in their rights to access to hotels and theaters, was seen as special treatment, to even the argument against segregation, which was seen as a preference. So the point of the matter is we have to always see these against the baseline in society. If we consider the baseline to be unfair, if we see the normal status quo as discriminatory, then these interventions are not seen as preferences. They're seen as equal opportunity. If, by contrast, we see society as basically benign, or we think it's okay that there are these deep structural differences that won't go away by ignoring it, but we think that's perfectly acceptable, then we'll understand these interventions as being preferential. I happen to be on the former side of the case. I think having structured inequality over centuries is inconsistent with the deepest values of America, and therefore any kind of intervention that is intending to try to bring about real equality is not preferential. It's in the deepest traditions of equality.
And does anybody on the side supporting the motion want to respond, either to directly address that question or to respond to
Booker T. Washington? John McWhorter knew a very different world than ours. And I personally would not be in favor of his particular view that people really should just pick themselves up and that's all. Really, people do need help. He never knew the New Deal. He never knew the Great Society. He never knew affirmative action when it was first instituted, which I personally think was a very important thing given the situation in the country at the time. However, his basic insight that there does come a point when, in order to cope with an imperfect world, you have to do it yourself. There comes a point, is one that I think is valuable. One reads his writings now, and they're not nearly as reactionary and foreign as one would think. I think it's an advance in our society that we do have a safety net, that we do have things to, for example, help the poor. For me, socioeconomic preference makes perfect sense. The issue simply is that today, there is not nearly as large an overlap between disadvantage and having black skin as there was in 1960 or even 1970.
So when you argue, it is revision. Time. When you argue it's time to end affirmative action, you would say this time is different from
an earlier
time.
It was about 15 years ago. Yeah,
about 15 years ago, it became time to end affirmative action.
Already got the microphone.
Oh, you have the microphone.
Yeah.
Can you? Yes.
Oh, okay.
And if members of the press, if you're here asking questions, could you please identify yourselves?
Oh, hi. I have a question on SAT, on this test. I had my undergrad studies back in China, science major. I moved on to law and business, but a lot of my classmates went on pursuing PhDs. And they did, and actually I did that too. We did a GRE test preparation. And I remember the time, you know, didn't have money, could not afford materials from the test center. So all we can prepare on is based on, you know, the past 10 years old exams in the public. Or, you know, even those things are not always readily available, you know, I remember the time. We have to get oil prints of those tests in 1980s. So, but the funny thing is, these guys all went into very high-level PhD programs. And in GRE tests, people out there didn't have so much preparation materials.
You have to come to the question now.
Actually beat U.S. people in a U.S. test, become the best-performing student's body, the Chinese guys. And if foreigners can do that, why people in the U.S. cannot?
If foreigners can compete with American students on the tests that we require them to take for admission to our graduate schools, why shouldn't we expect Americans to do so? Who wants to answer that question? Okay. Tim Wise?
I don't think it's a question of whether we ought to expect people to do well on tests. I think we ought to. And I think we ought to make it possible for folks to do so, no matter who's taking it, whether they are taking it from some other country, whether they're taking it from down the block. I think the real question, however, is whether or not we ought to be looking at that test, no matter how it's done on, by anyone, be they a foreigner or be they someone who is a citizen of the United States, as to whether that should be the criteria for admission. Now, the research on this is very clear, that the highest correlation you ever will get on an SAT, a GRE, a MCAT, an LSAT, or any of these tests with actual performance in the first year after the test is taken is 0.4. That's fairly pathetic in statistical terms, because what it means is that at most 16% of the difference between any two students can be explained or predicted by that score, meaning 84% has nothing to do with it. Why are we using merit criteria that don't really measure merit but do typically, not always, but overrepresent those who have those resources and those who are affluent? Not only, there are folks who don't have the resources who sometimes do well, but that's the highest correlation. It seems to me that we ought to be looking at alternative criteria, including things like testing, but not overemphasizing those, because we know that, in fact, when those students who scored lower, who maybe didn't score as well as those at the very pinnacle, get in at places like the University of California, that only about 5% of their grade differences can be predicted by the test score. So they're not being mismatched. They're not unqualified. There are other things that recommend them for the spot. So we ought to expect and try to make sure everyone does well. We also ought to have a criteria that is both more fair and representative, but also more accurate. It doesn't serve anyone's interest to use a criteria that does not, in fact, predict success, and those tests simply do not. In fact, once study of law schools, we're talking about law schools, University of Michigan study found that there was an inverse relationship between LSAT score and future professional success, meaning that those who did better actually did worse and weren't as happy in their jobs when they got out of law school and started practicing. So by that criteria, we ought to let all the folks in who bombed the LSAT because they're going to make the best lawyers.
Next question from the audience.
Can I just add something to that as well? I mean, part of it is also you said that these foreigners were able to prep, which I would imagine means that they speak English and perhaps are from a professional background, that they knew about these tests. And I think that is a big issue, that the access to the materials and access to information about the tests also isn't equally available.
Next question.
Good evening. Each of the panelists against the motion insists that the beneficiaries of affirmative action have been as successful as any other students in school. You know, if that's the case, should the children of those beneficiaries and the grandchildren of those beneficiaries, since it's been 40 years, should they continue to get the preferences afforded by affirmative action? And if it's not time to end it now, when is the time to end it?
Kim Crenshaw.
You know, one of the fallacies in this argument is the assumption that socioeconomic disadvantage has completely wiped out the ongoing reality of race disadvantage. Or to put it another way, people think that when we're talking about the black middle class, we're talking about the same thing as the white middle class. People think that sons and daughters of people with a college diploma are going to have the same kind of life circumstances as sons and daughters of white people with diplomas. Nothing can be further from the truth. If anything, the most significant difference between African Americans who are middle class and whites who are middle class is the 10 times the wealth difference between one another. Let me put it another way. Whites who have basically the same income still have between 8 to 10 times more wealth. Now, why is that important? Wealth is associated with everything that makes you competitive. It puts you in communities where you have the better schools. It puts you in healthcare situations where you have better care. It puts you in social networks where you hear more about what material you need to know, what opportunities are available for you. So the reality is that there is a lifetime of difference.
But to return to the question,
between being
let's narrow the question again. Doctors and lawyers who benefited from these programs, why should their children be beneficiaries of the same program?
And my answer is, why shouldn't they be? What do we have to know about the lives of African-American middle class to come to the conclusion that perhaps one generation ago they were socioeconomically disadvantaged, but in this generation they're not? In every major statistical finding about the actual life circumstances of African-Americans, there are still a range of disadvantages that they face. Now, is it going to be the same level of affirmative action as someone who is truly impoverished? Of course not. But most affirmative action programs don't function that way. They give you benefits for both being socially, economically disadvantaged and race as well. The point is, race still marks life of African Americans.
Any comments on this from the movers? Joseph
range
Phillips.
Of disadvantage. Disadvantages do not come with a black face. And this is why earlier I said we need to talk about people, because when we start talking these broad terms, we're talking about the black middle class. I happen to live in Los Angeles, down the street from Calabasas, California, which is one of the wealthiest communities in America. I coach football, and I have black kids on my team with parents who make more money than most, half of everybody in here added up together. The idea that these children are in need of preferences because they don't have access to the same benefits that their white counterparts is just ridiculous. Because we're not talking about individuals, suddenly we're talking about people generally in terms of their race. I also want to go back to address something else that was said, this idea of this testing. Look, right now, these are the tests that we're using. And I want you to listen very closely what we're talking about. Oh, the test, not the preparation, and on this. The underlying message is that our kids can't compete, that my three sons cannot compete, and I don't buy it. If we want to get rid of these tests, then let's get rid of them. Whatever standard we use, the standard should be applied equally to all kids.
Robert.
That's what we're saying here.
Briefly from John McWhorter, and then a reply perhaps from the opponents. John McWhorter.
I think that one thing that we are leaving out of the discussion, and you have to bring it in, is that much of the reason that middle-class black kids have trouble with submitting the same kind of file as a white kid would have is a tendency among black teens to say that it is white to do well in school. There's a myth nowadays... There is a myth nowadays that has been disproven, and I'd like to try to be as specific as possible here. Pacific is the word I'm using. But here I can't. That's a myth. There are many studies. I've looked at all of them in detail. All of them show, even when they don't think they're showing it, that there is a strong tendency for black kids to tease each other that way. There are reasons for it. But the question is, how do racial preference programs address that particular problem, which I think is addressable and is being addressed by things that go on before kids go to college? We can't just leave that out of the discussion because the data is inconvenient, and I think it's absolutely crucial to the things that we're talking
Robert,
about.
It's John McWhorter, and we've heard several points made by the supporters of the motion.
Can I respond
to the opponents, and Tim Wise, yes.
I just, responding to the last thing John said, I think it's interesting that he's upset about supposedly, ostensibly, middle-class black kids saying that it's white to be smart and somehow that's their pathology and that's the problem we should address. It's an issue. We could discuss it at a different time. What I find interesting about it is that you, John, are affiliated with the Manhattan Institute, which has received money from the Bradley Foundation, hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is a foundation that paid Charles Murray to write The Bell Curve, which is a book that doesn't imply that black people are inferior. It screams it from 40% of its pages. So when you say that black folks say being smart or doing well in school is acting white, the book, The Bell Curve, funded by the same people that fund the organization you work for, basically says the same thing. It says high IQ is white or perhaps Asian, and black folks are genetically defective. I find it disingenuous for you to put the burden of that on black children and not the very wealthy, well-heeled, well-funded white folks who actually print material that says black people are defective, and not one prominent conservative in this country, including the three of you, said anything public when the Bell Curve came out. Not one word, not one prominent conservative. Let's place our attention on those who actually say that white people are smarter and black people are inferior, and you won't hear that from any of us.
Yes. John McWhorter. John McWhorter, quick reply, then we'll get another question. Yes.
Sure. When the Bell Curve came out, I was very young. I had no public presence. I was studying linguistics, and so I don't know what I would have said. To the extent that Bradley funded that book, which I frankly did not know, and that they fund some work that the Manhattan Institute does, that's certainly true. Charles Murray has nothing to do with the Manhattan Institute and stopped, as a matter of fact, while he was writing that book. And what I'm funded for doing at the Manhattan Institute is things like working on prisoner reentry programs, et cetera. But what's important is that when I talk about the acting white phenomenon, I'm not saying that it's a pathology. I'm not blaming the black kids for this. This is something that happened as the result of a sequence of socio-historical things that ultimately have their root in racism. Nevertheless, it is there today, and I don't think that it can be denied. And the issue is to treat it and to show black kids that there are different ways to think along those lines.
Okay, well, enough about those other institutions, and back to questions from the audience.
Yes,
sir.
Thank you. Let's say that it's irrelevant what Harvard and Yale do with private institutions, and I don't care if they want to let two-headed people in. It doesn't mean anything. We're in New York City, the home of City University, a great publicly supported institution supported by all the taxpayers of New York City. The sons of cops and transit workers, teachers, retail people, garment salesmen, everybody. A publicly supported institution, so that when you have racial preferences, you are discriminating against taxpayers. You are discriminating not against George Bush, not against the legacy kids, not against that. Taxpayers either have a right to have equal opportunity for their tax money to be used for their own purposes, that is to get their kids in school, or taxpayers are to be denied that in favor of race and ethnic preferences. Justify your position, those of you who are against the motion, to the taxpayers of New York City when they want to send their kids to higher education.
Okay. A distinction between public, taxpayer-funded, and private institutions. Tim Wise?
Sure. City College used to have open admissions because it recognized that its purpose was to serve all the citizens of the city of New York. And it did that for a while. A lot of white folks who wouldn't have passed any test actually went to City College under the era of open admissions. And yet, when all of a sudden people of color began to, quote-unquote, flood, being the metaphor we often use, that hallowed institution of higher learning, then all of a sudden we started talking about standards and criteria and remediation, and these people aren't really qualified. I think what taxpayers ought to expect is open access and ability to get into institutions they pay for, because to get rid of affirmative action at City College or any public institution is to say that people of color who pay taxes should not expect representation for the taxes that they pay. And the same is true in contracting, and the same is true in public employment. I think City College ought to have open admissions. It worked really well for a lot of white folks for decades, and I think it's a really good idea for students of color as well.
And let me just add one point to the way that this conversation has done exactly what I suggested that it would. When this proposal is put on the table, it's talking about eliminating all affirmative action. It's not talking about eliminating just affirmative action that benefits African Americans. It's not talking about eliminating affirmative action in higher education. It's talking about eliminating affirmative action in contracting, in employment, in education that applies not just to African Americans, but white women and people of color as well. Let me point out what difference it makes to have this conversation focus on African Americans. Would any of this make sense if we were talking about white women? Would we actually say, well, you know, it turns out that the scores for white women actually overpredict their performance in law schools. Because when they actually get to law schools, even though they're equally qualified, if you take these test scores as meaning qualification, they end up not scoring nearly as well as white men. Would we even suggest that? No, we would think that there's something going on in law school that actually has the effect of suppressing their performance. Would we talk about women's cultural values? Would we talk about their work ethic? Would we talk about any of these things if we were talking about white women? No. Would we talk about any of these things if we were talking about Asian Americans or even Latinos? So the reality is that we're actually trying to attack a wide variety of programs by having a debate that's as old as this republic about the intellectual inferiority of African Americans. I would submit that you should repudiate this proposition just because it's not talking about the full range of affirmative action and the beneficiaries who are at stake in this conversation.
Another question from the audience.
Given this is a question for the people who are for the motion, my first question is whether or not you agree that integrated educational settings, whether it be in K through 12 or higher education, are important. And then secondly, given the pervasive and serious inequalities that we see in K through 12 education by race, what it is that you propose to do to try and open up the pathways to those institutions?
Which of the supporters of the motion?
I agree.
Karen Spell.
I think that there's real value to integrated education. There's value to diversity. But that's not really what this debate is about. This debate is about one means used to achieve integration, one means used to achieve diversity. And the way that's been used to achieve diversity is highly mechanical and imposes a lot of costs on African-American students in particular. And what we're saying is you got to look at those costs. You can't just sweep them off the table with this soothing, with rhetoric about the value of diversity. We all agree diversity is important. What we disagree about is the means used to achieve that diversity.
But is it so important in your view that indeed if you came into a class, if you were teaching and saw that all but one student in the room, everyone else is white, would you say we should be doing something? Is it so important that we should go revisit other values we're pursuing here, given the results I'm seeing? Or not quite that important?
You go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm glad you put that up, because I'm not convinced that diversity is all that important. Diversity in terms of skin color. I think that when we go to school, the people that we befriend, the people in our neighborhoods that we hang out with, are people that we share values with. When you talk to college students and people who have been to college and what was most important about their college experience, it had to do not with the color of the person sitting next to them, but the values of the teachers and those kinds of things. Of course, integration is a great thing. I'm for that. I'm for it when people want to do it. Am I for people manipulating and forcing people? I don't think that that's a good thing. I don't think that that's good for America at all. And I also want to make this point. We talk about how great diversity is, and yet the schools, how great diversity is for the educational benefits of our students, and yet the schools that are routinely churning out the greatest number of black doctors, the greatest number of black lawyers, are HBCUs, which are not racially integrated at all. Morehouse, Spelman, Howard, etc., 98, 99% black. That is not, in my opinion, a bad thing. And if it is, then Tim, maybe we should make sure that we get a critical mass of white girls down at Spelman and be on our way.
Robert, can I interject something very quickly?
HBCU being historically black colleges and universities. Brief statement, and then if somebody wants to make a very brief statement from the other side, and then on to closing statements.
I think we have to be very careful with the words integration and segregation as they happen to have drifted into certain implications in our time. Because often the way we're using the word segregation today implies something I'm very uncomfortable with, which is that the only way that black people can really excel is if white people are around. And I'm not comfortable with that. And so we talk about schools, and for me, a dominant image is, for example, KIPP academies, where all the kids are black or brown and poor, and they're being taught very well by dedicated teachers, and there are new KIPP academies every year. And somehow, on the other hand, especially in academia, it seems that we're supposed to keep talking about increasing segregation as if segregation now is always the same thing as it was 40 years ago, when actually a whole lot of black kids, poor black kids in a room together, can learn very well. That excites me. It is peculiar to me how unexciting that seems to be found by a lot of people.
I agree to a brief statement. So that was it. And one rebuttal, if you want to make it, from the side opposing the resolution.
Well, I guess the only thing that I'd want to point out to people in listening to this is that this anti-affirmative action argument is really a Trojan horse for a whole range of anti-integration, anti-civil rights, anti-equality policies. You've heard it. The bottom line is this whole Brown versus Board of Education experiment, this whole idea of forced integration was a bad idea when it started, and it's a bad idea now. So what this is a rollback. It's not just about racial preferences, whatever you define that to be. It's about what kind of society we really want to have. And this other side is happy to have societies, to have institutions that are racially separated, to have communities that do not interact with each other and have all white institutions, all black institutions, and all Asians. That's a rollback on the basic
that's
promise
a distortion.
Of the civil
okay.
rights movement.
Totally.
Well, you'll
distortion.
All have closing arguments in which to address some of what you believe are the misconceptions you've heard about the other side. The final remarks from the panelists are 2 minutes apiece. At 1 minute, I'll say one, as I'll be as loud as I can in saying that. And then after that, we'll get to vote on who won the debate. First of all, closing statement, 2 minutes against the motion, Tim Wise. You can do it from yours. These we can give from the desk.
Great, wonderful. Couple things. First of all, just to address something I think that was frankly disingenuous that was said by Terrence Pell earlier. He said that his organization does not advocate no discrimination laws applying to the private sector. In May of 2004, I got on their website. I was writing my book on affirmative action. It's footnoted in my book. Their statement of principles included the following. The Center for Individual Rights believes in the limited application of civil rights law and the right of private individuals to deal with others as they see fit. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean other than Woolworths gets to say black folks don't sit here and cab companies don't have to give rides. That's what it suggests. That's what it suggests. And you don't have to like that that's what it suggests, but that was what it said. Secondly, everyone up here on that side has said that affirmative action was legitimate in the old days because of the existence of persistent racial discrimination. They've all acknowledged it, which means we're not debating a principle here tonight of colorblindness in all cases. What we're debating is an issue of facts on the ground. If the facts on the ground say that discrimination is still a significant problem, then by definition, by their own admission, the debate is over and you have to vote for us. That's not a debate trick. That's basically what they're saying. The only side that has presented any information at all tonight, let alone analysis as to the existence of ongoing discrimination is this side of the aisle, which means all of the things I said at the outset about employment, about contracting, about education, and ongoing white racial preference has been utterly dismissed. If that still exists, their own standard of evaluation says that they lose and that we win. So just make sure you remember that when you punch those little buttons. The bottom line, and I'm going to quote, since I didn't get to read my Reagan quote, I'm going to do this, I promise, if you cut me off, it's the quote. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, 1974, last thing he did as he left office was sign into law the affirmative action programs. And here's what he said. He said, time and experience have shown that laws of anti-discrimination are not enough. Justice demands that each and every citizen consciously adopt a commitment
time
to affirmative action so as to make equal opportunity a reality.
We've run out of time.
Reagan was right in there.
Thank you, Tim Wise, for those closing remarks. You got your citation of Ronald Reagan in, after all. Now, as a closing statement, 2 minutes for the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, from Joseph Phillips.
If white folks are so racist, if they come out of the womb hating black folks, why on earth would we trust them to run affirmative action programs designed to bolster the education of black students? That's what I heard him say. So what kind of society do we want? I have a little more faith in the American people than I think some folks on the other side do. Because I think that the American people, they've spoken loudly in California, they've spoken loudly in Michigan, in Washington, they will speak loudly in Arizona, in Colorado, and other states in the upcoming election, that they are in favor of integrated societies.
One.
The American people are in favor of equal opportunity. What they want is fairness. I think it's quite a compliment that more and more people are saying, listen, They're taking the words of my mother, and they're saying, listen, there is no monopoly on brain power. Black folks can compete, and we want to give them the opportunity. And I think it's about time.
Thank you, Joseph Phillips, for that closing statement. Now a closing statement against the motion from Kim Mayong.
In talking about diversity and the benefits of diversity, now, the other side makes it seem like we're saying, well, you know, we want racially diverse classes, because if you're black, you have a certain perspective, and you're expected to carry the mantle of that experience. And same with if you're Asian or white or so forth. And that's not what we're saying. There has been mountains of evidence about the benefits of a diverse educational environment and of a diverse workplace that was produced. In the University of Michigan cases, this was produced before the court, and I'm sure that Mr. Pell's organization fought that with the best arguments that they had, and the Supreme Court voted in favor of diversity. Also, with regard to the process that educational institutions use to accept students, it's a very flexible, individualized process. The type of admissions plan that was endorsed by the Supreme Court in the University of Michigan case is individualized. There are no quotas. It's not mechanical. One. Because Mr. Pell's organization actually won the case at the undergrad institution, which found that the undergrad policy at the time was too mechanical. So it's a very individualized consideration. And, you know, the last thing I want to leave you with is it's what we call the causation fallacy. Even without affirmative action, whites' chances of admissions only gets in at our most prestigious, it only rises at our most prestigious institutions by 1-3%. According to that Bowen and Box study, the one by the university presidents, it only rose by 1.5% for the average white student. That's because there's a whole lot more white students than minority students that are applying. So even without affirmative action, it's not going to increase a lot of people. It's not going to increase any individual applicant's chances of getting in by a whole lot. So this whole thing about how every white student that has been admitted, or even every Asian student who, you know, sometimes believes that that's the case, thinks that I would have gotten in if it wasn't about affirmative action. That's simply not
Thank
true.
Thank you, Kim Mae-ung, for that closing statement against the motion. And now a closing statement in favor of the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, from John McWhorter.
I think that when we're evaluating this debate, a crucial thing to realize is that there is no denial on any of our part that there is inequality in our society. This is the crucial point. Looking at the nation that we're in, looking at the history of the world, looking at the nature of our species, it is logically unclear to me that there ever could be a human society where the playing field was completely level. Now, we can work on things, but it's always going to be imperfect, and it's going to be imperfect enough to matter. You can be committed to social justice while realizing that because society cannot be perfect, what our job is to teach people who didn't come out with as many chips as we would have liked to cope and do the best that they can despite the imperfections of the system. Now, if somebody is down on the bottom, of course, I personally am in favor of there being help, of there being relaxations of standards if necessary. But when this is simply a matter of skin color,
One.
I think that we have departed from what the original intentions of these policies were. The issue is not waiting for there to be no inequality or discrimination. The idea is, when do you let it go? Because there's never going to be a society that's completely without it. And in closing, I would like to say that there is evidence pro and con for this, and I don't see on the other side any engagement with the con. There is an understandable sense that their arguments are God's arguments, the only ones worth mattering, and that anybody who has different ideas is funded by sinister people or has a different agenda, et cetera, et cetera. It's not true. To be honest, I've studied their stuff. I know the pro. There are other arguments written by cogent people, many of them not conservatives. These people don't see those arguments as worthy of engagement. Their case, therefore, is incomplete. I think you should vote for us.
Thank you, John McWhorter. Now, final remarks against the motion from Kimberly Crenshaw.
When affirmative action was withdrawn at the University of California in Berkeley and in UCLA, the participation of African Americans and Latinos fell to levels that we haven't seen since 1968. When you think about whether you want to vote for this proposal, you should think about whether you're satisfied with that. When you think about whether you want to vote for this proposal, you should think about whether you're satisfied with the fact that women contractors lost a 35% share of the contracts that they had had in California as the result of 209. When you think about voting for that, you need to think about women as well as people of color. Now, the other side says we don't talk about some of this evidence. Let me tell you something I will talk about. They tell you that students who graduate from Spelman, who go to Morehouse, who go to Howard, miraculously ultimately end up doing better than going to the elite institutions that they might otherwise have gotten into. They want you to think that the reason they do better there is that they're over there where they should belong with all the other black people.
One.
What they're not telling you is that these institutions have a track record knowing how to encourage students, educate students, to create an environment where students feel confident to do their best. So rather than taking that as an indictment of the institutions that have taken qualified students and not allowed them to do their best, they follow the track and the proven tradition of focusing on stereotypes about African Americans. So my point is, if you're unhappy with the inferences that are drawn from this position, if you're not a colorblind fundamentalist like Colin Powell, who is not, like Condoleezza Rice, who is not, then you know that there's still work to be done in this society. You know that this inequality is something that has to be addressed. And you know that just like any other social problem we care about, like asbestos, it would be silly to think we're going to solve asbestos by being asbestos blind. It's silly to think we're going to solve the problem of race by being colorblind.
Kimberly Crenshaw, thank you very much. Final remarks from Terrence Pell for the motion, It's Time to End Affirmative Action.
Well, tonight all of us are gathered here to defend the principle of equality, and I think we do that with a sense that equality is under siege as never before, and that's because real equality is never achieved. It's always coming into existence. As our opponents say, there's a lot of work to be done, and that's true. But today, the challenge to equality doesn't come from the political extremes. It comes from really the political middle. Moderates have tried to eliminate differences in achievement among black and white 18-year-olds by essentially engineering an admission system that makes them go away. And with characteristic efficiency, those preferences have been extended to every institution after undergraduate college, including professional schools and public and private employment. Though they aren't intended to do so, these policies perpetuate racial differences and they corrode social bonds. They make it difficult for minority high school students to attend schools where their credentials would make them academically competitive.
One.
And that's the point about the historically black colleges. It's not that blacks ought to go to the HBCUs. It's that the white schools, the elite schools, ought to learn from the way the HBCUs run their admissions programs. They admit on the basis of merit, and it makes a big difference. The most troubling aspect about tonight's debate has been the reaction of our opponents to efforts to disclose the problems and end these policies. Our opponents essentially demand that we continue to wink at real differences in qualification and demand also that we remain discreetly silent about the predictable consequences of this winking. It's time to put an end to race preferences. It may have been a good idea at one point, but it no longer serves a useful purpose. There are too many other important issues that we need to be talking about if we're going to achieve real equality in our lifetime.
Terrence Bell, thank you very much. That concludes the final remarks. It's now time for you to decide who carried the day. Once again, please pick up the keypad that's attached to the left armrest of your seat. And after my prompt, press 1 if you are for the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, 2 if you are against the motion, and 3 if you are undecided. Please cast your vote now. Fine. I'd like to thank the debaters and all of you in the audience for your good work. And before I announce the results of the audience vote, I want to take care of a few things. First, the next Intelligence Squared U.S. debate will be on Tuesday, December 4th, here at Asia Society and Museum. The motion to be debated then is, aid to Africa is doing more harm than good. It will be moderated by WNYC New York Public Radio's Brian Lehrer. And the panelists for that next debate will be for the motion, economist and president of the Free Africa Foundation, George Ayite, professor of economics at New York University, William Easterly, and writer and policy analyst, David Reif. Against the motion, co-founder and former president of AfriCare, C. Payne Lucas, deputy director of the UN Millennium Project and associate director of the Earth Institute, John MacArthur, and Gail Smith of the Center for American Progress. An edited version of tonight's Intelligence Squared U.S. debate can be heard locally on WNYC AM 820 on Sunday, November 25th at 8 p.m. These debates are also heard on more than 80 NPR stations across the country. Please check your local NPR member station listings for the dates and times of broadcast outside of New York City. Copies of books by John McWhorter and Joseph Phillips are on sale upstairs in the lobby, and you can also purchase DVDs from previous debates here tonight or from the Intelligence Squared U.S. website. And now the results. After the debate, 39% of you were for the motion, it's time to end affirmative action, against 55%, undecided 6%. The team against the motion carries the day with an absolute majority and a stronger increase. Congratulations to the team against the motion. Well done. And good evening.